The following episode contains discussions about eating disorders and related topics that may be triggering to some listeners. If you or someone you know is struggling with an eating disorder, please listen with care. The content of this episode is intended for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional advice. Listener discretion is advised. This is On the Verge. So, Jack, welcome to On the Verge. I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much.
I was thinking kind of where I wanted to take this conversation. Firstly, because a lot of the things I saw that you post and stuff were such a relief to me. So I want this conversation to feel like a relief to people who listen to it. I feel like social media has a whole aspect that is very linked to a lot of the topics I want to get into. And in the other, like the flip side of the coin is people like you who are posting more of the reality of things and how some things might affect us and our relationship with food, with our bodies and stuff like that. And unfortunately, I think 99% of women relate to it, which shouldn't be the case. Yes, we totally do. A term that you mentioned a lot is food freedom. And I wanted to begin there because some people might not even know what it is. What do you mean when you say you're like advocating for food freedom?
Absolutely. So I guess for me, I think food freedom can mean a lot of different things for different people. But specifically for me, a little bit of my background is I struggled with anorexia and restrictive eating and overexercising. And so a lot of that mindset kind of built a lot of fear around certain foods that I would, or that society deems as unhealthy. Like when you think like pizza, donuts, pasta, things like that, that you kind of hear are not the best for you and aren't the healthiest option. It kind of cultivates a lot of fear around that. And so myself, and I know a lot of people have just end up kind of building these restrictive kind of rules that like you're not allowed to eat these certain things. And then just achieving food freedom to me is kind of having the ability to eat those things without the little voice in the back of your mind making you feel guilty and making you feel bad about it. Yeah. Kind of, I guess for an example, when I was younger, I never would have had a day where like on a Sunday, I went for a leisurely walk. There's no goal of, you know, exercise. There was no goal of burning calories. And then on top of that, I went and had a bagel and didn't necessarily think anything of it, just enjoyed it and then didn't have to feel the need to go burn it off after. And I'm able to do that now, but that was something I never used to be able to do before without that mind, or sorry, without the voice in the back of my mind kind of just telling me like, you can't do that. You have to go burn that off, or you didn't earn that and stuff. Yeah. So I guess for me, that's kind of what food freedom means, is moments like that where you're
something
able to.
Something that comes to my mind when you say this also with the word freedom is like freeing your mind from always being thinking about like what I'm going to eat, how am I going to eat it? It's like, and I think we've, most women would relate to this, that we're maybe thinking about the whole day, like what meals you're gonna have, at what time, and maybe you'll be hungry in the middle, like what can I snack that's not too crazy, like, and it's a jail. It's like your mind is in a jail of thinking about food all the time, which is insane.
It's so, like you're almost a slave to just calories and thinking about and obsessing over food and what goes in, what comes out, all of that.
100%. In what moment of your life did you first start to become aware of this, like thoughts that you were having and maybe the relationship with your body or stuff like that?
I would say I remember being consciously aware and thinking of, you know, thinking I'm fat and what I'm eating when I was 12, when I was in fourth grade. My mom thinks that it happened, like started a little bit earlier. She noticed in me kind of having those thoughts and behaviors. But for me, in my memory, I've also blocked a lot of stuff out too.
Enough. So that's normal.
There are things that I don't remember, but I distinctly remember in fourth grade, someone actually called me fat. And that was the first time that I was like, wait, am I fat? And I remember asking this girl that I was in class with, and she kind of looked at me like, what does that even mean? Like, what do you mean? Are you fat? And so that was kind of like a very distinct memory of mine.
Yeah. So that's pretty early on.
Pretty early, yeah.
That's a long time.
Probably too early for someone to be worrying about that. But I feel like now with social media,
it's so
it's
common.
Younger and younger.
I was thinking, because I wanted to ask you that question, I was thinking about that myself. Yeah. And I think like the first time I started to become like hyper aware of my body was maybe around 13. Mm-hmm. I think it's also common to like
puberty, yeah, as your body's changing.
Yes, definitely. So it makes sense. And it's like that, mm-hmm, it's crazy, but how like one little fucking comment can, mm-hmm, ruin your psyche. And it's like the most triggering, yeah, thing.
And it was like the stupidest comment ever too. It was like, we were on the playground and this kid was just like, you're so fat, you would eat a styrofoam tray. Which, tell me how any part of that makes any sense, yeah, at all. Like, it was, yeah, just a 12-year-old boy being silly, whatever.
Yeah.
It meant nothing. And when we're that young, we don't know the power of our words and what we say. Yeah. And obviously this person was not expecting that to stick with me. And by no means was that, you know, anything that caused any sort of behavior in me. But it was just one of those things that stuck with me. That,
yeah,
kind,
yeah,
of,
you just started thinking about
it. Made me start thinking about things. And it's like, you just, I don't know. Yeah. It's,
and
crazy.
So how did this evolve from when you were 12?
Yeah. So
to, like, the peak of you having like a problem.
Absolutely.
Around
food. I would say the peak was when I was around 14 years old. So I was a freshman in high school.
Wow.
And so when it first started, so actually that can't, sorry, I totally misspoke. I was not 12 in fourth grade. That does not make any sense. I was 10. So yeah. 10 when that first started happening.
That makes more sense.
And then I was 12. So I was kind of getting the timeline a little messed up. So I started taking dance lessons as I got a little bit older. So in fourth grade when I was 10, when that started kind of entering my mind, I also started taking dance lessons. Like hip-hop, ballet, all of that. Nothing, you
ballet,
know, nothing,
the world of body positivity. What do you mean?
I know. I was by no means like professional or trying to be professional, but it was like a fun, yeah, kind, yeah, of after-school activity that I would do. But the issue was I hit puberty before a lot of the other girls. Mm. So I was surrounded by a lot of very thin girls that hadn't reached puberty yet. And so more comments were made. So that didn't help. But I would say as I got closer to eighth grade, I started moving more, like running in gym class. I joined the track team in eighth grade. Not, you know, anything super serious, but enough that I started to realize that changes that I made in my diet and exercise were showing physical changes that I was actually really happy with. And so I was really young, so I didn't fully understand what was happening and, you know, what exactly, yeah, a diet and exercise, you know, I wasn't a gym rat by any means at, yeah, like 14, but I definitely started to notice the changes and I liked that. And then it just kind of got more and more strict and rigid around my relationship with food. I was starting to have a hard time kind of going out to eat. I wouldn't want to eat anything. I pretty much only ate salads when I, wow, did eat. And I remember my mom just thinking, you know, I was too young, because this was still when I was like 12 that I was starting to start just cutting out, like, no snacking, no, you know, popcorn, no pretzels, no things that like a child would have for a snack and not really think twice,
yeah,
about.
That's the thing, you're a child. That's an important point.
Yeah. And so I would say my freshman year of high school is when it got really bad. I joined the cross country team and I started actually really running pretty
long distance,
and I was actually kind of good. So I was on track to beat some records. And so I was kind of, I'm a very competitive person. So I was like, I have to keep going. I have to beat these records. And so I was running more and more, but I wasn't fueling my body. And so eventually that, you know, did not lead to the greatest circumstance. Yeah.
No, obviously. Like, it's your body can only, mm-hmm, perform at that level if you're fueling.
Yes. Also, I laugh sometimes when I talk about this, because I kind of have that like coping mechanism of just laughing and kind of inappropriate humor, probably, yeah, or self-deprecating
no,
humor.
No, every traumatic experience, yeah, I've ever had, I can only laugh about it, so don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But so you have this peak moment where you're, mm-hmm, not doing well. How does the, like, what's the mindset shift where you're like, I need to recover? How, mm-hmm, does that process of recovery work?
So
how does it even start?
I know. That's a hard one. It's, for me, and for I think a lot of people that struggle, when you're really, really deep into it and when it's starting off, it starts off innocent. It starts off with just kind of goals of you want to get healthier, or you maybe want to lose a few pounds, or kind of just reach some sort of fitness goal,
yeah,
that ends up just getting out of hand. Kind of that's what happened with me, is I wanted to just kind of lose a few pounds, and then it was never enough. I had to keep losing. Every time I hit one milestone, I was like, that's not enough. I have to keep going. That's kind of like we kind of refer to it as Ed, the eating disorder, the Ed voice in, yeah, your mind, which I'm sure everyone has maybe a different name for it, but that's kind of what my therapist and I called Ed. And so kind of Ed in the back of your mind telling you that, you know, it's not enough, you need to lose more. And kind of along with body dysmorphia, when you look in the mirror, you don't necessarily see the changes. You kind of still see what you've always seen, or the fat person that you think that you, or feel that you are, to be very blunt, is kind of, you know, is honestly something I still struggle with at times, of looking in the mirror and not really knowing what I even look like, because first of all, every reflection is different. So it's kind of hard to truly know.
Yeah, you can't really ever see what you look like,
you
which
really
is crazy.
You really don't know, because it's, if the angle's off, if the mirror is, you know, narrow. Yeah. Anyway, that's a whole other conversation. But I do remember going through months of in and out of treatment. I was in and out of some inpatient programs, some outpatient. I was hospitalized for a little bit. And it wasn't until I went into the hospital that I really realized that I actually had a major problem.
Yeah.
I could physically feel that I was declining. You know, my heart rate was really low. I was always cold. I laying down was very uncomfortable because it was just, I was very bony and there was no kind of cushion. So even laying on like a mattress was like, you just felt like you were laying on a rock. And so I started to feel those things after a while, because you're kind of so caught up in it, you're not really paying attention until you kind of slow down and you really start to learn and start to work through things when you are in treatment and start to really become aware of the thoughts. Because at first the thoughts are kind of just happening. You're not really paying attention to them. They're in the back of your mind. And they're causing you to feel certain ways and kind of pursue different behaviors. And then as you start to work through that, you start to identify these thoughts that are kind of triggering the behaviors and the feelings. And being able to recognize that and separate yourself from that, to realize that these are not healthy, that these are causing me to do unhealthy things, and kind of be able to take a step back from that and look at that from like a healthy perspective, per se, and realize that, you know, you're actually damaging your body and you're not sustaining, you're not doing anything sustainable. And ultimately for recovery, having a team around you is really important to encourage you, to kind of help you and show you, you know, what recovery can look like, what life can look like when you are recovered, and that, you know, you might think you're in control and that you're doing really well, but really you're not in control. And so that's all helpful, but ultimately it does have to come from within too. I know I went through months of, you know, my mom and my team, I had a therapist, a nutritionist, and a doctor, all kind of that I would go see on a weekly basis, kind of helping and supporting me, and just kind of telling me and kind of encouraging me, and my mom kind of pleading with me to, you know, try to want to get better and want to put in the work and do that. And it wasn't until the day I was going into the hospital that I kind of really was sitting on the floor realizing that I needed it was going to be really hard, and there was still a part of me that wasn't quite ready, but I knew that I needed to, or else I probably wasn't going to make it. And it was kind of like that moment, that rock bottom moment, that I was like, it wasn't really a light switch per se, but it was a shift in my recovery where I actually did want to recover. It wasn't just I could recover someday. It was like I actually do want to recover, and I do want to take my life back.
I can't imagine how hard that must have been. I'm really glad you got better.
Thank you.
You also mentioned, here you see your mom, right? Trying to make you realize. I imagine it was extremely hard for her too. And I think a lot of us have lived through a situation where we see someone who's going through that and you feel so useless. Is there anything that people around you can do? Because I never knew, and I feel like I've seen this situation maybe when I was a bit too young. I imagine as a parent, it must be extremely hard. Is there anything that a person around you can do that does help?
There are definitely, I would say there's no right or wrong way. Well, maybe there's some wrong ways to approach. Definitely approaching very harshly is probably not.
What are the
wrong
ways?
Wrong way.
No, actually, that's so useful.
Honestly,
like, knowing what not to do is also really useful.
For me, trying to force me to eat, trying to kind of be like, just eat. Like, I get that it's so frustrating. You think like, just eat, just do this. Because people that don't understand the mental aspect of it, they, you know, which I wouldn't expect someone that hasn't gone through it to really understand that. But a lot of people come at it kind of like, just eat, like it's not that hard. Or I've had someone actually like force a spoonful of peanut butter down my mouth one time.
Oh my God.
Which was very much not the right way to handle it. She's my best friend. I love her. And we're still very close to this day, but I remember being so angry at her, and we were so young, she didn't know.
Yeah, that's that's the thing.
That was her reaction of being like scared of seeing her best friend, like, I'm losing you, I don't know what to do. And so she literally tried to, which was very much the wrong approach, but she was like 13.
Yeah, so trying to help
you don't know. So don't do that. So I would say, you know, very harsh approaches like that, probably not the way to go. I know I had one friend who I've actually talked to more recently about this, who said that the one thing that she tried to do is not make it about food. So instead of, you know, trying to say, let's go have a snack, or like, you should eat something, she would kind of say, I'm going to go have a snack, and kind of like dot, 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 leave it open for like, if I wanted to join, but no pressure. Mm-hmm. And kind of take the emphasis in this, in that, off of the food, and more off of like, she was going to go do that, and I could, if I wanted to. And I actually, thinking back, never hadn't noticed that in the moment, but thinking back when she told me that, I'm like, you know what, you were really the only person that I didn't fully like push away, because you never pissed me off during it.
Yeah.
Because you didn't just try to control me and force me. You were very kind of, you were there for me, and you were always there if I needed to talk about it, but you didn't force me to. And you were there in a different kind of like more delicate way, if that makes sense. Mm. And I feel like that was a really great approach, because it was hands off, which sometimes that won't work. But as a friend who's not as involved, I felt like that was a really good way to make just a safe environment. So like, food could be involved without it being the focus, if that makes sense.
Yeah, without like a confrontation, basically.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Not trying to fight you.
Yeah, not like you need to eat kind of thing.
And I think that's a really good point to make, because the person even that's forcing you, like, they're mm-hmm. really just desperate to help you. It's,
yeah.
I think it's just not talked about enough to like, what can a circle of support do for that person?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard. Also, it's very common for it to present itself in high school. And it's like, your friends are also babies.
So
like,
young.
Like, they don't
no
know
No one knows
to
how
do,
to
yeah.
handle that. Like,
yeah.
It's just, it's one of those things that if you're not going through it, you're not going to understand it, especially at such a young age. Like, I didn't even understand it.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's not easy for the person going through it, and it's not easy for the people around them.
No, definitely. It's hard for everyone. I imagine for you, like, the memories from that are not good at all. But I'm glad we're here and that you're doing so much better. But you did mention, for example, with looking at yourself in the mirror, even now.
Mm-hmm.
Or I imagine you might have situations where, like, some things come back to you. I don't know. Like, I think this is just a generalized thing that I've mm-hmm. heard. I don't remember where, and I think I've heard it more than once. It's like, you're always in recovery after mm-hmm. having an eating disorder. Do you feel that way about it? Is that something that's true? Is it like a day-to-day recovery, even after
like
you got better?
Yes and no. I think sometimes it's not as prevalent. I think there are some days and some stretches of time where that voice is almost non-existent. I think it's maybe for me always kind of in the back of my mind, but definitely there have been times where it's kind of just, it hasn't really been prevalent in my life. And then there have been other times where it has come back enough to actually be a significant issue. I wouldn't call them a relapse per se. I feel like that's kind of a harsh word, but I have had struggles since the initial, like, I kind of had that first initial really intense battle, mm-hmm. I'll call it. And I have had, I think, two instances since that have been significant enough that I would say I was actively really struggling. And actually one of them was within the last few years, kind of right when I moved to New York. It's sort of like a year and a half ago. And so I've been out of that for a while. But I feel like there are different kind of phases where you're at in recovery. And I think there's kind of when you're first coming out of it, you're still very fresh and you're still easily triggered. You're still struggling. You're still fighting that. And then the further you get from that, there are moments where you might fall back into it, but you can pull yourself out of it pretty quickly and pretty easily. And then there are times where you're just almost not even thinking about it. And you're pretty kind of just easygoing and life is kind of happening and you're just kind of happening along with it. And you're not really thinking so much about the voice in the back of your mind.
Makes sense. I also imagine over the years, you kind of started identifying what mm-hmm. sort of thing triggers you. Do you have any mechanisms that help you like handle those situations where you're like, okay, this puts me in a spot that's not healthy for me?
Mm-hmm. So I would say, from the first time that it happened, it was when I was graduating college. So it's interesting. So the first time was going into high school. The second time was graduating college. And then this most recent time was like a major move, a major breakup, and all of those. So it's always
life
been
changing,
significant,
pressures.
Life-changing. things. And for me, it's a control thing. It's when something is happening around me, and especially with my emotions, I go to controlling the food, controlling my weight, controlling that. And so I've been able to identify that aspect as well as the thoughts. Because I most recently, kind of how it happened was I went through the breakup, which caused a lot of anxiety, and I just lost my appetite. So it started off purely just anxiety and I couldn't eat. And then it kind of shifted into I've lost some weight. I kind of like how this feels. And it was more of it turned into a control thing. And so kind of being able to identify that and be very self-aware, I've had really significant struggles with anxiety as well, I'd say. So I'm very, very aware of just the thoughts that are going on in my mind and trying to identify and just kind of let go of those anxious thoughts that can really take control and kind of cripple you. So being very aware of the thoughts and kind of not giving them power has been the biggest tool for me. I would say my therapist kind of, I don't know exactly how this helps me, but it does help me. She's like, think of the thoughts like a cloud. And she's like, you see the cloud, you acknowledge it, and then you let it keep going and move on and not take power over you. And that has somehow helped me. I don't know exactly how. I've just kind of taken that analogy and just been like, okay, I acknowledge the thought, I'm having it, but just like, it's just a thought. I can't control what happens. If I have a fleeting thought, then it moves on.
Yeah.
And instead of, you know, obsessing over it, I kind of just try to move on.
Also, to each their own, there's probably like a million mechanisms that people use. If that works for you, go ahead, like use it. So you said it happens with like this big moment in your life. Does this also, what areas of your life does it most affect? Is it like socially, emotionally, what are the repercussions when you start going into that mindset?
It's definitely a lot of the aspects of my life. So socially, it did impact, you know, going out and going out to eat. And so I started dating someone, been almost a year now. So I started dating someone who's like a big foodie. Yeah. And I'm not the biggest foodie. Because I have a, you know, very tumultuous relationship with food, but it's actually helped a lot because this person has been very understanding and not kind of, as we go out and like he'll kind of do his thing and he'll eat whatever he wants to eat. And it's not really about the food, it's about the experience. It's about being out, it's about being in a restaurant and around people. And like, you know, the excitement of food, I've been able to get more relaxed around. And kind of, I was very rigid of like not wanting to eat after certain times and not wanting to eat certain things. And so he's actually really helped me with that because he's like, I have dinner at 9 o'clock. And I'm like, I can't eat after 8. And he's like, why?
Yeah.
Explain that to me. And I'm like, and then I talk it out and I'm like, okay, that doesn't make any sense at all. So that's been really healing. But before that, it was hard to kind of go out to restaurants and have, you know, food in social settings because trying to avoid eating is a big thing. When you try to avoid a meal, obviously, if you're around people and you're not eating, they might start questioning.
Because also, like, when you think about it, social situations are always around food or drinking. It's rare to see someone if you're not like drinking or eating. It's like, what, I don't know, maybe
I know
it's
no,
like,
it
a, like a cultural thing for I don't know, but all cultures that I can think about,
it's a very social thing to do.
It's a social thing to do, and I think it's good to try and see it as that, right? It's like taking the food center from it and making it like, oh, I'm gonna see my friends, and that's healthy for you. So like, yeah, just kind of letting that into your life. And
yeah,
glad that's a like a process.
Yes.
I also want to get a bit into your, it sounds to me like you had a bit of a quarter life crisis outside of the like of relationship with food and everything. I think it's a very common moment to go through in your 20s, and this is literally what the podcast is about,
which I love, by the way.
How did you transition like from that moment of your 20s where it's like, oh, my life's a mess, what the fuck am I doing? You went to Italy on a solo trip with it, which is like so eat pray love of you.
It was amazing.
And then you come out on the other side of the crisis. Like, what's that journey?
So it was definitely a shit show. Essentially, I moved to Queens with my now ex, and we had been together for 6 years, and I ended up ending that relationship. It wasn't the future for either of us. And so that was like the biggest change. Like, I had just been, then I was in a new city because we had just moved here, I think 2 months before we ended up breaking up. So then I find myself in Manhattan, staying on some stranger's couch for 2 weeks because I was kind of like, I'm not going home. This is where I've always wanted to be. And now I'm here. I'm not going to go home. I gotta figure this out. So I had met someone at a networking event like a month before. And so when we'd gone on a girls' night out, like right after the breakup, and she's like, if you need a place to stay, I got you. And I was kind of like, no, that's okay. I'm like, I didn't want to impose. And then it turned out that I did need a place to stay. So she's like, well, you just stay with me. And neither of us thought anything of it. I was just like, sure, why not? And she's like, great. And so we did that and it worked out great. She actually was here from, or she is here from the Canary Islands. And she was kind of going through a time where she was feeling like, I don't know why I'm here. I'm very lonely. I don't know if I love the city. And then when I came into it, we were roommates for 2.5 weeks, and she told me that that kind of made her fall back in love with New York City, and having someone there got her through that period. And she similarly got me through that period of fresh off the breakup of not being alone. And so that kind of was a really positive, I guess, aspect of that. And then just, the breakup, the being in a new city, not having my own apartment yet, kind of just not really knowing, like at 28, being like, I just blew my life up. What did I just do? Like, I don't know what's going to happen next. I don't know where I'm going to be living. I tried to just go with the flow. And my motto was kind of, why not? Anytime someone was like, do you want to do this? I was like, why not? You know what? What do I have to lose? Why not? At this point, everything has changed. So why not? So that was probably the best thing that I did, was just kind of continue to say yes and just be open to all these opportunities. And of course, not everything was rainbow and sunshine. I definitely had some low moments. I had some, when I booked the trip to Italy, it was like January, I was freezing. I was in my apartment and I was kind of like, I'm so lonely. I don't really know what I'm doing. Like, yes, I love New York and I'm having so much fun, but I'm also just kind of floating here and I don't really know what I'm doing with my life and I need to make a change. And so I just spontaneously booked a trip to Italy, which was the best thing that I could have ever done.
The dream. That's what we all wanted to do and we don't do it, but you did it.
I tried to talk myself out of it. So I booked it for July. So I gave myself like this, like a 6 month, like I booked it spontaneously, but like booked it out. So I didn't just kind of book it and then go right away. I booked it for my birthday. And so like the week before my birthday, the week before the trip is actually when I met my boyfriend that I'm dating now.
This all sounds like a movie. It's like, been with a guy for 6 years, moved to New York, broke up right after, lived in my friend's couch.
That's why this most recent chapter of my life has been like a quarter life crisis, but also the most amazing time of my life. It's been the most uncomfortable time and the best time at the same time, if that makes any sense at all.
No, that sounds, you know, as you were speaking, things that came to my mind, you're saying as well, this was the most rewarding time of your life. And it seems that you're letting control go. Whereas all your problems come from trying to control everything and everything just got better when you just like released. But so sorry, I interrupted you and I want to get into the love story. So you meet your boyfriend a week before going
technically, it was 2 weeks before. So he lived in the same, this is like a little weird side note. So I lived in Forest Hills, Queens. I moved in there July for 2 months. He actually lived in the same neighborhood, but moved out a month before into the building that I ended up in.
Oh, wow.
And I had never met him. I'd never seen him until the day we met in July. So it was like 9 months of living in the building. And I was leaving one day and he was standing in the lobby talking to the doorman. And I just kind of, I wasn't going to stop and say hi, but I ended up stopping and saying hi. And Julio introduced us and we were both just like, I was going to Whole Foods. And so I left, I went to Whole Foods and I'm walking out. This is like 10 minutes later, I'm walking out and I walk out of the Whole Foods and I started going one way because it was really busy. And then I just about face and start walking the other way. And as I'm walking down, and if I hadn't gone this way, this wouldn't have happened. I look up and I see this guy and I'm like, wait a second. I just met you 10 minutes ago. What are the odds? And so I just, without really thinking, stopped and said something, like hi to him and said something. And it turns out he was outside of Whole Foods because he knew I was going to be there and he wanted to bump into me again. And then
that's
I was
so sweet.
It was really cute. And I was kind of like, is this happening? Like, I didn't know anything about him.
He was masterminding in it.
Right?
Because you were like, oh my God, I ran into him again. Right? He's like, no.
That was like, this was all planned. Mastermind for sure. Taylor Swift taking it from her. But it was like a whirlwind. So the whole weekend, I was kind of thinking about him and that, because I was like, if I did anything differently, I wouldn't have seen him again. And so I was like, okay, explore this. And so I end up going back to the doorman the next day, being kind of like trying to be sneaky about it. And I was like, I need friends in the building, because he has a dog, because he was walking his dog outside of Whole Foods. And so I knew he had a dog, but I didn't know if he was single. And so I go to Julio, and he's just like, okay. And I was like, with dogs? And he goes, well, Christopher, his name is Christopher, has a dog. And I was like, does he? And he was like, he does. And he's single. And I was like, is he?
And then he was Julio like, is the best.
He's the best. He will be at our wedding someday. That's for sure.
He should. Yeah.
But long story short, I was going to leave. So this was, I met him Friday. I was leaving that following Tuesday to go home for a couple days and then come back and then go to Italy for the week. And so Julio knew this, but obviously Christopher didn't know this. And so back and forth between Julio and I, and kind of like Christopher and Julio, which his name is CJ, and calling him Christopher now sounds weird because he goes by CJ now. But I end up kind of telling Julio that I was like interested, and I'm like, you know, I don't know anything, I'm interested, but whatever, if he's not, no big deal, like whatever's gonna happen is gonna happen. He goes, well, you know, he kind of said when you walked away, there's no way she's single. And I was like, you know, that's funny, because I thought there's no way he's single. When I saw him with this gorgeous dog, there's no way there's not a girl in the picture. He's like, no, I'm pretty sure he's single. And so he ended up kind of, you know, conversing with him, conversing with me. We bumped into each other like one more time. And then Monday came and I was like, I'm leaving. Like, it's, I feel like the window is going to pass. And so I was like, Julio, just tell him I said hi when you see him. And he's like, okay. So he did. And then he texts me that night and he's just like, so, and so I'd been talking to him earlier in the day, and he was like wanting me to watch a video. So I was thinking, oh, he wants me to watch the video, he didn't watch it. So I respond, I'm like, oh, it's funny. And he's just like, so, and I'm like, haha. And he just goes, Christopher's down here in the lobby. And I was like, is he? And then he sends me a picture of a sticky note, and it had Christopher's number on it. And it was basically like, I heard you're leaving, I didn't want to miss my chance, texting you back. And then the rest is history.
Your story is so romantic. Jack, thank you so much. This was so amazing.
I hope you enjoyed it. Wow, this was so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. See you next time.